loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. After his first month in office marked by mass protests, fierce infighting, and heightened diplomatic tension, President Donald Trump has delivered a wide-ranging speech to Congress and to the nation. China's top diplomat wrapped up a two-day visit to the United States yesterday and met with Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, to discuss the strained U.S.-China relationship and prepare the ground for a summit between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping. Residents near the site of the proposed THAAD missile system the United States plans to deploy in South Korea have filed a lawsuit as a global movement of protest and resistance against the deployment grows. But first, we turn to Donald Trump's speech to Congress and to the nation. We are joined from Seattle by Jane Cutter, the editor of liberation.news.org, and by Juan Jose Gutierrez. He is the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition in Los Angeles. Welcome. Jane Cutter, let me turn now to you. Donald Trump is promising a massive increase in the U.S. defense budget. $54 billion more, that's a 10% increase in the official budget. The official budget isn't the real military budget because U.S. wars, for instance, like the one in Iraq that cost several trillion dollars, were off budget. But there are other ways that the budget is concealed. The Department of Energy has a big part of the military budget. The real U.S. military budget is about $1 trillion. But this kind of spending comes in what is called the discretionary part of the federal budget. It's not about Medicare. It's not about Social Security. It's not about the entitlements. If the discretionary budget has a provision that increases military spending by 10%, that means that money's coming out of other parts of the discretionary budget. I mean, this is like guns, not butter. War, not people's needs. Go ahead.
Absolutely. It is outrageous, and it is absolutely the opposite of the direction that we need to be going in if we are to be a society that is decent for working and poor people to live in, because right now people are already, many people are really living on a very, very, very thin ice with dramatic increases in homelessness and poverty. Everywhere you go, you see somebody sleeping in a tent, and yet we have, apparently the U.S. government has not only enough money for $1 trillion military budget, but now for $54 billion more or so Donald Trump is proposing. This is something that we need to mobilize to stop, just as our mobilizations appear to be having some impact on the immigration the crazy immigration agenda that Donald Trump has been pushing. Just so must our activities, our protests, target this issue as well and say no to the increase, to any increase in military spending. And in fact, we have to demand that this military spending be dramatically slashed.
We're speaking with Juan Jose Gutierrez. He is the executive director for the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition in Los Angeles. Donald Trump spoke to the nation tonight on February 28th, the first time he spoke to both houses of Congress. Before the meeting, he had signaled a perhaps dramatic shift on his immigration policy. Of course, Trump, during the election campaign in 2016, it said, we're going to build a wall, which he still says he's committed to building, and implied that he was going to begin the deportation of as many as 14 million undocumented people living in the United States. And since he took office, he's issued executive orders that have allowed the ICE agents, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to go on a rampage against immigrant communities, creating fear. But now the New York Times says that the president is planning to possibly provide a legal pathway for undocumented people to achieve citizenship. Juan Jose Gutierrez, dramatic shift. Do you believe it?
I read initial articles this afternoon, and I'm in shock and disbelief that after directive and after directive and executive orders, all of them very much anti-immigrant and racist, that the president will now shift gears and, in fact, offered an immigration plan that presumably will extend not just legality to stay and work in the United States lawfully to millions of undocumented workers, but in fact, a path to citizenship, at least for the so-called dreamers, those that were brought as children by their parents who were undocumented and now have applied for and received a temporary work permit, which they're obligated to renew every 2 years. So I still don't believe it. I have to wait and see the details of what the president is going to ultimately be proposing to Congress before I can have a more definitive opinion on whether or not this is truly a momentous development or it's just populist rhetoric to undercut the mass mobilization that he has provoked with his mass raids against undocumented communities across the country.
Juan Jose Gutierrez, final question. Donald Trump has record low ratings and very high disapproval ratings among independent voters, amongst Democrats. Obviously, we know people have been in the streets. Perhaps as many as 20% of the U.S. population has participated in a protest since November 8th. The Republicans, though, within his core base, have been very happy about all of these draconian anti-immigrant positions, as well as the other positions that Trump has adopted. What would be the reaction of the Republican Party leadership to a shift on the part of Donald Trump? Will it require a break between Trump and the Republicans, or will he take them in tow if he does this?
Well, I think that there will be a break with the hardcore right-wing fascist sector within the Republican Party who don't want any kind of mercy for undocumented workers or dreamers. They want Donald Trump to be true to his promises that he will unleash mass raids and mass deportations to the tune of some 14 million people getting removed forcibly from the country. And I think that there will be a break with that sector if there is any positive movement on the part of the Donald Trump administration. I think that the more traditional Republican member is going to be willing to give them the benefit of the doubt and just like me, wait until they see all the details and what exactly he's going to propose to Congress at some point in this congressional session. So I think that a significant segment of the traditionalist Republican Party it will probably support the president if he does move in the direction of offering some kind of legal relief to the undocumented population. I think that people are tired of this process that has dragged on for well over three decades, and we still haven't been able to fix it. I think that Donald Trump wants to govern not for four, but for 8 years. And he understands electoral math. And he knows that if we were able to somehow find reconciliation with the Latino and other immigrant communities that have been very badly affected by his most recent decisions in the way of executive and other directive orders, he knows that that will be very, very beneficial to his political future.
Jane Cutter, I want to talk to you also about the environment, because I'm sitting here in Washington, D.C. It's been over 70 degrees on 7 days in February. It's the hottest February on record in Washington, D.C. Last year was the hottest. The year before that had been the hottest. In other words, it's getting warmer and warmer and warmer. It's obvious that global climate change is happening. Scientists have validated it. Big business has validated it. Donald Trump and climate deniers, of course, are moving in a different direction. Also, they're moving to help the corporations that feel inhibited or obstructed in some ways from their goal of maximizing profits by regulations that are designed to protect the environment. Just before his speech, Donald Trump signed an executive order rescinding the waters of the United States rule and instructing the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, to come up with a new rule. John Devine, the Natural Resources Defense Council senior attorney, called this move an all-out assault on the nation's water quality. What's the implication of this?
Well, the implication is clear that of corporations to make a profit will take precedence over the right of not only the people on the planet right now, but of generations to come to have a safe and habitable place to live, a safe environment, and the right of not only humans, but of all species to continue to exist here on Earth. It's less important to Trump and to capitalists like him than their right to make a profit, to show a profit on next quarter's balance sheet. And that is why this system of capitalism has got to go, because it is the major thing standing in between a safe environment, a healthy environment, a healthy planet, or the no longer existence of the planet as we know it, of the environment as we know it.
I mean, that's an interesting point you make. I know as a child we were all told don't litter in order to solve the problems of pollution. Of course, during those years, Lake Erie, for instance, and other parts of the Great Lakes were really dead lakes. Then, of course, the environmental movement came to life and demanded that the corporations stop polluting. The Clean Water Act comes from that. Some of the U.S. waterways started to come back to life, but, of course, many are terribly, terribly polluted. I mean, how could it be that the President of the United States could proclaim that the Clean Water Act is an inhibition to profit-making for corporations, and that not lead to grand resistance by an entire generation of people? I'm talking about at least the younger people, and I don't mean very, very young, but younger people who realize what's at stake.
Well, I think we are seeing that. We are seeing, as you mentioned, some 20% of the U.S. population has participated in a protest since November. You know, right now, tomorrow will be the first day of March, and we're looking forward towards April and Earth Day and the Science March. And I anticipate we're going to see large numbers of people out in the streets defending climate science, demanding that evidence-based action be taken to stop climate change and to otherwise protect the environment. It's not just climate change, although climate change, if it's allowed to go unchecked, is going to be literally a game ender for all of us. But there's other things that need to be protected in the environment. And it is always in the interest of the capitalists for their short-term profit to just keep on polluting, keep on doing whatever it is they think they need to do in the short run to make profit. And that's the problem with the capitalist system, is it's always about the short-term gain, and it's never looking forward to what is the long-range impact on the majority of people and on the majority, in this case, really, of beings on our planet and ecosystems, and how do we protect that as a resource for all of us moving forward, rather than a private resource to be exploited by the few for their own personal gain.
You mentioned that maybe as many as 20% of the people in the United States have participated in some protests since Donald Trump was elected November 8th. The Democratic Party has trying to harness those protests. They're trying to turn those protests into basically a cheerleading group for the Democrats. They're positioning themselves. A lot of the people who are demonstrating, though, are demonstrating against the Democratic Party. They're demanding that the Democratic Party really resist the very, very most reactionary policies of Donald Trump, like the 10% increase in the military budget, like what's happening to the environment, what he did earlier to immigrants with the executive order, which has led to he says it's not mass deportations, but it really has been up until this point. The evisceration of women's rights, the abortion rights, the right of women to control their own bodies. Now, Nancy Pelosi, who's been the leader of the Democrats in the House of Representatives for a long time, made the point that the Democrats should not be the way the Republicans were with Obama, where they said no to everything, where they said, we want Obama to fail. In other words, they showed complete, absolute resistance to anything that Barack Obama did, including when he introduced the Affordable Health Care Act, which, of course, was Mitt Romney's health care plan for Massachusetts. In other words, a Republican plan that privatized all of health care, but they called that socialism. Here's what Nancy Pelosi said when people were demanding that the Democrats really say no to Donald Trump on all of these issues. She said, "I think we have to deal with this in the utmost dignity. We cannot become them," meaning the Republicans. "We don't like what they did to our president. We cannot be outclassed by Donald Trump. That would be the worst of all outcomes." I mean, ever since Trump came into office, Obama said, "We want him to succeed because the country will succeed." Now you have Nancy Pelosi saying, "We don't want to be outclassed. We don't want to be the party of no." In other words, the party of really stiff resistance against some of these most reactionary policies. Are the people in the streets able to break away from that kind of Democratic Party leadership? Or do you think that they will be sort of funneled into the 2018 midterm elections or 2020 elections, just as voters now for the Democratic Party because they loathe Donald Trump's policies? What will happen?
Well, just listening to that quote from Nancy Pelosi, I think I threw up a little bit in my mouth. It's just ridiculous what she's saying. And the Democratic Party is just a complete dead end. And I sincerely hope, and I think we're all end of not allowing the people in the streets to be funneled into the Democratic Party. As I said, it's a complete dead end. It's a complete waste of time. It can't be reformed. They proved that themselves, if nothing else, over the summer at their own convention, with the way they handled the Sanders movement. So they can't be reformed. There's no hope. There's no hope for our struggles in that party. We have to be stridently independent and truly resisting, and that's what's going to get the goods. It's going to be that resolute resistance that's going to turn this thing around.
Resolute resistance. That was Jane Cutter, the editor of LiberationNews.org. We were also joined by Juan Jose Gutierrez. He's the executive director of Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. We talked to him from Los Angeles. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Yang Jiechi, China's top diplomat, the state counselor for the People's Republic of China, wrapped up a two-day visit to the United States yesterday and met with Rex Tillerson to discuss the strained U.S.-China relationship and prepare the ground for a summit between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping, the leader of China. We are joined from San Francisco by David Ewing. He is the chairperson of the San Francisco branch of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. Welcome back, David.
Nice to be back. Thank you.
Thank you for joining. The readout from the State Department said, in part, quote, "United States Secretary of State Rex Tillerson met today with Chinese State Counselor Yang Jiechi and affirmed the importance of constructive bilateral relationship and of regular high-level engagement between the United States and China." Was this trip an effort to smooth over the turbulent relationship between China and the United States since Donald Trump? Well, not since he became president, since he won the election back November 8th, 2016. Is this an effort to get things back on track?
I guess so. You know, China has had a consistent policy toward the U.S., and they haven't challenged things like the one-child policy. So there's this pretty steady, you know, policy directives from Beijing. So it's been on the U.S. side, right, that there's been a lot of fluff and talk about different things. So I think the Chinese are just pressing for an even keel and wondering what, like we are, Brian, what Donald Trump will do next.
Last week, Donald Trump said about China, about the People's Republic of China, "I think they are grand champions at manipulation of currency." Again, you hear all of these efforts to sort of smooth things over, and then you have Trump intervening over and over again with provocation. But is there any truth to the accusation that China is a currency manipulator? I mean, it's pretty easy to criticize other countries for manipulation when your country's money is the world's reserve currency. Go ahead.
China, you know, this is something that the U.S. invited, actually. The U.S. wanted the Chinese to float their currency in a basket of other currencies. Before that, China controlled its currency. Now it floats. So the fact that the value of the Chinese currency against the U.S. dollar has declined, that's a product of international market forces. It's not something designed by the Chinese. And the Chinese have tried to make their currency stronger lately. So either the president is misinformed about this, or maybe what's more likely is, you know, his nationalist view of economics is overcoming, you know, the sensible reality about what's really going on.
Right. And also, wouldn't it actually damage China in some ways? Of course, a currency that was weaker, say, in relationship to the dollar would mean Chinese exports to the United States would be relatively cheaper for Americans to buy or U.S. companies to buy. But on the other hand, China holds a great part of the U.S. debt. I mean, the U.S., I don't know how much. I don't know if it's $1 trillion or $2 trillion. You probably know. But it would seem to me that if the Chinese government is holding a lot of U.S. government debt, bonds, securities, in other words, and the Chinese currency is depreciating, that would make it more difficult for them, no?
Yeah, and you know the classical political economy, free traders don't worry about things like this because, you know, if China's products are cheaper, we can buy them at lower prices. That's a big advantage for U.S. consumers. If Chinese prices are lower, we can get a better deal. So, you know, in a traditional view that a free trader would have, and many of the Republicans, perhaps not Trump, are free traders, there's an advantage to the side that has the stronger currency. So it's a pretty mixed bag. I guess the idea is that if the Chinese currency is cheaper, you know, more capital will move into China to take advantage of the lower labor costs and, you know, the be able to produce things cheaply for the American market. Maybe the U.S. will lose jobs. Isn't that the idea? But I think most job losses are due to automation in the U.S. and not because jobs are leaving for foreign countries.
Let's go back to the readout that the State Department issued following the meeting between Yang, the state counselor, the Chinese top diplomat, and Rex Tillerson. The readout said this: also discussed areas of mutual concern, including North Korea's nuclear program. Now, in the last couple of weeks, the news media picked up the fact that China has cut off any more coal imports from North Korea this year. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that was because they had already hit their quota or whether it showed a deterioration in relations between North Korea and China, who are historic allies. Go ahead.
I think it's true. Yeah, China has dramatically reduced coal production internally, too, so that, you know, there's been complaints that, you know, because coal is produced in the northeast of China, that it's caused job losses as mines are closing. But China has to worry about the impact of coal, you know, emissions from the plants that produce electricity for China. They're moving away from using coal, and they're moving to cleaner sources of energy nationwide. So they are reducing their coal. But I think part of the coal they buy from Korea isn't because they need it so much. It's a way of subsidizing an ally, North Korea. So I think it does have a political impact, and it's probably designed to send a message to the North Koreans that China is unhappy with some of the things that have happened.
Well, will that work with North Korea?
I think so. You know, I think North Korea and China have a good relationship. It goes back an awfully long ways. And, you know, I think there are signals from both sides. North Korea, you know, China and has its own set of policies. North Korea has its own set. I don't think it's in China's interest to try to bully North Korea, and I don't think they will. But I think it's fair to let people know that if we have a disagreement, it's going to be expressed.
Well, parts of the North Korean media were vitriolic against China afterwards. They didn't explicitly mention the reduction or the cutoff of coal imports, but one of the media reports from North Korea was really, I mean, by diplomatic standards between allies, kind of over the top. It said it characterized China as being dancing to the tune of foreign powers and acting like a great power. In other words, it showed anger on the part of the North Koreans. Is it possible that there could actually be a separation between North Korea and China? Because at the end of the day, even though the People's Republic of China has disapproved of this or that, has certainly favored the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, they haven't wanted to carry out actions that would push North Korea so far away that it would really increase completely the isolation of the government during difficult times.
I'd be surprised if anything of a break like that happened. I'd be surprised because, you know, the deployment of the new THAAD anti-missile system to South Korea is something extremely worrisome to China and to North Korea, of course, directed at them, so it said. But, the missiles are really, I think, part of the U.S. ring, aggressive ring around China and Asia. So it's, I think that North Korea can be a counterbalance to that kind of aggressive, missile deployment that is a threat to peace in Northeast Asia. So I don't think the Chinese will break relations, or that's likely to happen.
Yeah. The one thing that has been noteworthy about China, and I've been on Chinese media myself, where it's obvious since Trump's election that the Chinese were concerned. First, Trump said, well, we're going to have good relations with Taiwan. Why shouldn't I have direct communications with the leader of Taiwan, which was a break in protocol? Then he said, we won't necessarily follow a one China policy, which had been the bedrock for U.S.-China bilateral relations. Then there was no meeting between Xi Jinping and Trump until Trump actually told the Chinese leader on the phone that, yes, we do respect the one China policy. It seems like from the beginning, Trump has been all bluster, where China really had a bottom line. And the bottom line was, you must recognize these bedrock principles like the one China policy. And so it looks, in fact, that Trump isn't the good negotiator, that he, in fact, you never know what his bottom line is. Is it all bluster? And the Chinese seem to be standing pretty good right now.
I think so. And, another thing for the Chinese to contend with is the announcement by the president. I guess we'll hear it tonight on television, but he will give an address wherein the president is expected to demand an increase in U.S. military spending. So that, that kind of, who is the target of such military spending? It must be countries like Russia and China that are the main brunt of that. So another factor that the Chinese have to think about, and there's, we don't know yet how the money will be spent or what the details are, but why does the U.S. need to spend more? It doesn't seem like a credible use of funds if the president wants to fight the employment problems we have in the U.S.
One thing about the increase that Donald Trump is going to has announced, is a $54 billion increase. $54 billion increase. That's 10% of the official U.S. military budget. Now, the U.S. military budget is actually more than that, because the wars that the U.S. has been fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq were off budget. Also, in the Energy Department and in other agencies where it really is military operations, it's not called that. The real military U.S. military budget might be $1 trillion, certainly larger than many, many other countries combined, maybe most of the countries in the world combined.
China is still China is a developing country still. So they can't, they have to choose guns or butter. And, China has chosen the path of socialist development. And that's where the resources are flowing. They're trying to increase people's living standards as quickly as they can. Just a measure of their focus. The U.S. spending, of course, is high, and it has not. It's been a great amount has been. Donald Trump, I think, explained that a great amount was spent on the wars in the Middle East with bad results, according to him. So why he would continue doing this, I guess he can explain it to us tonight.
Yes, indeed. Let's talk now what is coming with Trump. I mean, Trump is going to try to have normal relations with the People's Republic of China. Will he back off from the Asia pivot? I mean, will he do something different from what Obama did, which was to place by 2020 60% of the U.S. Air Force in the Asia-Pacific region, 60% of the U.S. Navy in the Asia-Pacific region? I mean, is there a real difference in the Trump foreign policy towards Asia, or is this more continuity than change?
There was a difference in the way he spoke about it before the election. So I think before the election, I think, you know, the America First Trump was talking about reining in, you know, some of the expansion of military power. So, but now we have this counter to that is the expansion of spending, at least. So what does it really mean? It's just unclear to me. But if he is consistent with what he promised before the election, maybe there will be maybe some of the aggressive plans from that Hillary Clinton and President Obama both supported. Maybe some of those aggressive plans will be, you know, washed out or rethought. But I don't think I can't tell so far from President Trump's policy declarations what he's going to do about the pivot.
David Ewing, in our last 2 minutes, I want to ask you to characterize where the Chinese economy is really going. China is led by the Communist Party of China. It says they're building socialism with Chinese characteristics. There is a great deal of direct foreign investment. Ironically, Xi Jinping at Davos becomes, and the Chinese thus become, the main promoters of globalization, which is still globalization within the context of a world capitalist economy, not a world socialist economy, because such an economy doesn't exist right now. I mean, is China have a different sort of economic model? Is socialism still on their agenda, or are those just words at this point?
You know, in China, all the land of the country is owned by the state ownership, just like it was in Russia before the counter-revolution. So that there is tremendous social ownership, not only of an important thing like land, but also of all the main industrial enterprises, the leading technological enterprises, steel production, you know, all the high tech stuff is really in the hands of the state. So state planning still controls the main part of China's economy, although they have lots, as you say, lots of in some foreign investment and lots of individual capitalists in China. But the capitalists in China are focused on things like real estate, like they are here, and then they are focused on retail. So most of the fortunes in China are made either in retail or real estate speculation. They don't control the major lifeblood industries of the state the way that capitalism in the U.S. does. So
that's a fundamental difference between the economic model in Western advanced capitalist countries and China. In other words, the state, which is under the leadership of the Communist Party, still directs resources and directs development. That's not the same function as the state, say, in the United States or in the UK or in the Western powers. 1 minute left.
Yes. And, you know, in China, capitalists who break the law are often jailed, punished if you evade taxes. There have been many cases of capitalists doing such terrible things, they end up getting executed for it. It would be unbelievable if an American capitalist were executed for anything, right? If the head of General Motors were executed, that's just beyond the pale. It's not something we could even imagine. But in China, things like that have happened. The party really controls the state, and when people violate the interests of the working class, they can get in a significant amount of trouble, unlike here.
So really, China, socialism with Chinese characteristics is a new iteration, perhaps, of what Lenin started to develop in 1921, the new economic policy in Russia after the Russian Revolution, when the Bolshevik Party, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, determined that the relations of production had not developed, or the means of production had not developed fully enough to really a guarantee socialism. So it was more or less a mixed economy. Anyway, it's very interesting. We want to discuss this more, David Ewing, in the weeks and months to come. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Residents near the site of the proposed THAAD missile system the United States plans to deploy in South Korea have filed a lawsuit as a global movement against the deployment grows. We are joined from New York by Hyun Lee, a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea and the Task Force to Stop THAAD in Korea and Militarism in Asia and the Pacific. Welcome back, Hyun.
Hi.
Thank you for joining. Hyun, RT reported yesterday South Koreans have staged a protest against a land swap deal which will see their country host the controversial U.S. defense missile system, THAAD. Some living near the host site have also filed a lawsuit against the defense ministry. Tell us about the land swap deal and the legal and mass actions taking place in Korea right now to stop the deployment of THAAD.
Yes, U.S. and South Korean governments announced last July that the U.S. will deploy the THAAD system in Sungju, South Korea. They want to put it at a golf course that is owned by the Lotte Corporation. The defense ministry offered Lotte another piece of land in exchange for the golf course. And Lotte was supposed to make a decision on this land swap offer back in January, but that decision was delayed because China, which is very strongly opposed to the presence of a U.S. missile defense system in South Korea, was putting a lot of pressure on Lotte by threatening its business ventures in China. So, for example, ordering an audit of all of Lotte's retail stores, halting the construction of a mega theme park that Lotte had planned in China. So Lotte was getting pressure from all sides, and the delay in its decision was really what was holding up the Pentagon from moving forward with the THAAD deployment. But earlier this week, Lotte finally reached this decision to move ahead with the land swap. So now the Defense Ministry of South Korea has the land. It's going to go through some formalities according to the Status of Forces Agreement between the U.S. and Korea, for example, doing an environmental impact study. But really, it's just going to be a formal formality procedure. And then South Korea will presumably hand over the golf course to the USFK, the U.S. forces in Korea. Once that happens, then the USFK will immediately break ground to begin construction. And the USFK has said in the past that its plan is to deploy the THAAD system by late summer or early fall of this year.
THAAD is referred to in the U.S. media as a defensive weapon. The supporters of its deployment also use that kind of language. They say it's protecting South Korea from North Korea, from North Korea's missile program. But it actually seems to be useless for its ostensible role in intercepting North Korean missiles. Is that right?
Yeah. So deploying the THAAD system in Sungju, which is in the southeastern part of South Korea, seems to have two strategic purposes. One is that the THAAD radar, if it's stationed there, would extend U.S. field of vision in its surveillance of Chinese missile activity. The U.S. says the radar will not be used for spying on China, but China is not buying that, and this is precisely why China is so opposed to it. Also, if North Korea were to attack Seoul, which is the capital of South Korea, where half of the South Korean population is concentrated, North Korea would use short-range missiles flying at low altitudes. The THAAD system is designed to intercept mid to long range missiles flying at high altitudes. So it would basically be useless in defending South Koreans in that scenario. If, on the other hand, North Korea were to attack U.S. bases in the region, which is the more likely scenario, it would use mid to long range missiles to reach Japan or Guam. And that's what that system is designed to intercept. So contrary to what the South Korean Defense Ministry says, the intended purpose of THAAD deployment is not the protection of South Koreans, but it's the South Korean people who will end up bearing the burden of hosting it.
And what are the main burdens?
There are several reasons why South Koreans are opposed to this system. Number one, they are worried about the radioactive waves that are emitted by the THAAD radar. They're worried about the negative impact that will have on their own health as well as their crops. Sungju is very well known for its melons. That is, melon production is the main source of livelihood for the majority of the farmers who are there. They're worried about the long-term impact of the THAAD radar on their crops, understandably so. Missile defense expert and MIT professor Ted Postol has warned that THAAD deployment will actually put South Korea in the crosshairs of a potential conflict between China and the United States. So China will perceive South Korea's action of accepting the THAAD system in South Korea as a hostile action against China. It's going to undermine South Korea's relationship with China. Also, should there be a confrontation, a military confrontation between China and the U.S., China's first target for a nuclear strike could be the THAAD system, the THAAD radar in South Korea. So obviously that is very dangerous for the residents who are living near the THAAD system in South Korea. And lastly, the burden for both South Koreans and U.S. citizens is the cost of deploying the THAAD system. It costs $1.3 billion to manufacture, but then there's also an additional $22 million that goes into operating the THAAD system. Nobody has talked about who will actually pay for this. Neither the South Korean nor the U.S. governments have said they're going to foot this bill. Presumably that will be part of a future discussion between the two countries when they renegotiate the status of forces agreement. People in both countries should be very wary of the costs associated with that deployment.
Well, that's amazing. Of course, it's not an equal negotiation on the status of forces agreement because South Korea is occupied by American troops and Koreans are not occupying Americans, the United States, I mean. So we have a situation whereby the United States may, in fact, impose burden on the Korean government and thus the Korean people to actually pay for a deployment that puts those same people in the crosshairs in a potential confrontation between the U.S. and China. And given the Asia pivot, when President Obama went to Australia and announced the so-called Asia pivot, which is really a military pivot in the main because it means the deployment of 60% of U.S. Air Force and 60% of U.S. naval assets into the Pacific region by 2020. I mean, in all ways, this is a bad deal for South Korea and for the South Korean people.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And which is precisely why the residents near the deployment site, Sungju and Gimcheon, have been protesting. They've been holding protest actions every day for 200 days straight since the decision was announced last July. They're mostly elderly farmers, mostly women with children who are at the front lines of this fight against U.S. missile defense. The Won Buddhists are also joining in the fight because the birthplace of their second highest leader, which is considered a sacred site for them, is near the deployment site, near the golf course. There's also a national task force that is composed of peace and anti-war organizations. They have all come together to oppose the THAAD deployment. So all of these forces are working together. Recently, they've been protesting outside the defense ministry, also outside Lotte department stores. They have camped outside in the middle of the winter, outside the headquarters of the main opposition party to get the party to adopt opposition to THAAD deployment as its platform. They're also suing the defense ministry on the basis that it violated democratic procedures in the way that it acquired the land for the deployment site. It should have gone through discussion in the National Assembly and allowed for democratically elected representatives to review the merits of deploying this weapon system. But instead, the Pakone administration, in its very typical autocratic fashion, even as she faces impeachment and has no legitimacy in the eyes of the public, they are still railroading this through with no transparency at all and against the will of the people in Sungju and Gimcheon. If the land is handed over to the U.S. forces, the residents of Sungju and Gimcheon have said that they are prepared to do whatever it takes to block the construction. This is going to be an uphill battle, and I think the fight will intensify in the coming months.
In January, Michael Flynn, then Donald Trump's national security advisor, visited South Korea and declared that Trump intended to follow through with the deployment of THAAD. Then we had Secretary of Defense James Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis. He visited South Korea along with Japan in early February. That was the first foreign visit by high Trump administration officials since Trump took office on January 20th. He met with South Korea's acting president, who you mentioned. Mattis said, "Right now we have to address the reality of the threat that your country and my country faces, and we intend to be shoulder to shoulder with you as we face this together. South Korea and the United States must try to extract a change in North Korea's strategic calculus by deterring the North's aggression." Now, that would suggest that there's a political motive that Mattis had, which might suggest, too, that if deterred, North Korea could take a different position in relationship to South Korea and to the United States. And then the logic following that would be that perhaps there could be a change in the U.S.-North Korean relations. Now, we know that there was a supposedly going to be high-level discussions between North Korea and the Trump administration. They were scheduled, in fact, for March 1st and 2nd. The State Department, even as of last Friday, had announced that the visas for high North Korean officials had been approved. And then hours later, the White House announced that the visas would not be approved. And thus, the back-channel discussions, which weren't completely back-channel because they were known to the media, and obviously we know about them, but they weren't official. In other words, they didn't have state-to-state stature. They were canceled. So how is this all playing out? Is there a division, do you think, within the Trump administration over policy on North Korea? Or was the cancellation due to the sensationalized news about the alleged assassination of Kim Jong-un's half-brother in Malaysia, supposedly by North Korean agents with an internationally barred or banned chemical agent? That created a lot of hoopla. That story came from South Korea, and we know the South Korean media and South Korean intelligence routinely issue such sensationalized stories as part of the demonization. But help us navigate through all of that.
Yeah, you know, it's a lot to navigate. And unfortunately, so far, this administration's foreign policy plans have been so opaque that I'm afraid I don't have many answers. You know, I will say that at the end of the Obama administration, it was the consensus in Washington, basically, that his policy of strategic patience against vis-a-vis North Korea was a failure. That basically waiting for and preparing for the collapse of the North Korean regime, you know, did not succeed. Obviously, North Korea has not collapsed. And on the contrary, it has moved forward with its nuclear development program. And many experts agree that within the next 5 years, so certainly while Trump is in office, assuming that he doesn't get impeached before his 4 years is up, that North Korea will have the capability of launching an ICBM with a miniaturized nuclear warhead that can reach the continental United States. This has a lot of defense experts worried. And this presumably was the impetus for some back channel talk between the U.S. and North Korea. U.S. is probably very interested in finding out, is there a possibility of capping at this point North Korean nuclear weapons development, and what are the North Koreans interested in exchange? You know, I assume that was the goal of the back channel talks that were arranged. It seems that there is a divide in the Trump administration over North Korea policy, because now, as you've mentioned, those talks have been canceled. You know, the other curious thing is, what are U.S. plans for the upcoming Key Resolve Full Eagle military exercises? These are annual exercises that take place every year in March and April. They are massive exercises South Korean and U.S. militaries conduct to simulate the collapse of the North Korean regime, very aggressive war games that the North Koreans protest every year. And this year they have said, we are ready to launch an ICBM, test launch an ICBM in protest against these exercises. The U.S., it's curious, by now, this is end of February, the U.S. Should have already announced the dates, the precise dates of the military exercises. We have not seen that public information. And there were contradictory reports coming out of South Korean media, the Yonhap News, about this year's exercises. On the one hand, they quoted South Korean Defense Ministry officials saying the U.S. will deploy all sorts of U.S. strategic assets, and it's going to be the largest military exercises ever. On the other hand, there was another report in Yonhap in late January saying, actually, it's not the U.S. that's going to lead this year's exercises. The South Korean military will lead this year's exercises for the first time ever. The two reports are highly contradictory, obviously. The South Korean military cannot lead in military exercises that involve U.S. strategic assets. That makes no sense. So we are seeing contradictory messages about U.S. Approach to Korean Peninsula and North Korea in particular. So I think you are right that there is a divide within the Trump administration. There's certainly lots of confusion about which way we'll go forward. So I think we'll have to closely watch and see.
We will closely watch it. And of course, Korea, as a flashpoint, perhaps the most heavily militarized part of the planet, is of course a source of possible confrontation, but could be the place where a new U.S. policy could be developed. Certainly, I believe the North Koreans would reciprocate, would be looking forward to such a position should it come, something that would normalize relations. But we will continue to follow this story. We've been talking with Hyun Lee. She is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea and the Task Force to Stop THAAD in Korea and Militarism in Asia and the Pacific. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.